Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Three eight-year-old boys vanished from their West Memphis neighborhood one sunny afternoon. A day later, their mangled, nude bodies are found in a drainage ditch. Police and prosecutors believe the killings are related to the occult. Three teens are arrested 1 month later. Damien Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly Jr. are convicted. Award-winning journalist George Jared takes readers inside one of the most famous criminal cases in U.S. legal history. Witches in West Memphis gives a comprehensive insider's view into the West Memphis 3 case. No author, documentary filmmaker, or journalist has had more access in this case. Jared recounts his firsthand court coverage, interviews with witnesses, research, and other information he gathered in the case. Interviews include one on death row with Damien Eccles, interviews with Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly Jr., and interviews with other suspects, including Terry Hobbs. He's been credited in numerous documentaries, including Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, and the New York Times bestseller, Life After Death. Witches graphically recounts how three Boy Scouts, Stephen, Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers, rode their bikes after school on a bright afternoon. Their bodies were found in a wooded area near their homes the next day. The manner of death and the way they were bound, ankle to wrist, made authorities think Satanists might have sacrificed the children. No real evidence tied the teens to the crime, but an error-riddled confession by Miskelly was the proof used to seal the verdicts in the case. As time passed, overwhelming scientific evidence was discovered. Witnesses changed their statements. New suspects rose to the surface. The book that we're featuring this evening is Witches in West Memphis, The West Memphis 3, and Another False Confession, with my guest, journalist and author, George Jared. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, George Jared.
Hey, Stan, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for returning back for the first program in 2018. Welcome back. Thank you very much. Let's get right into this because as True Murder fans know, we've looked at this case. Again, it warrants looking at it many, many times, and I'm glad you're back on today to look at this even closer than we have in the two previous times that we've examined this case. Let's talk about the entire case because you had this talk about this incredible access. Let's talk about where you were when this crime occurred. Let's talk about that before we talk about how this case, you came back into it, or it came back into your life back in 2008. So let's talk about how, where you were and what you were doing and who you were working for at the time when this case broke.
I was actually a teenager when the case broke back in 1993. I had just moved to Arkansas from the West Coast. And I heard about it through news reports. It's kind of funny. My parents still have a bunch of VHS tapes. You know, people used to record like the news or other things. And I was actually in my dad's shop one day, just a couple of years ago, and he still had a bunch of those tapes. And we were going through them, and I noticed one tape from around, like, and it was, you know, they had dates on them. And actually have a copy of the news release that the night that the three guys were arrested on the local news in Jonesboro, Arkansas, because we just moved there and we weren't really familiar with, different, like times when news would come on and whatnot. So I was a teenager, heard about it. A few people around me, you know, everybody was scared, you know, at first, you know, because nobody knew who killed these three kids. But then, you know, time passed, and I'll be honest with you, I basically forgot about it. I watched the documentary Paradise Lost probably around 1998 or 1999. I do remember seeing it in a local video store, and for the most part, I just kind of forgot about it. I was actually at a softball game, and in 2008, I was working at the Jonesboro Sun as a journalist, and I get a call from one of my bosses, and the boss asked me if I could cover a hearing for the West Memphis 3. And so I said, sure, no problem. I got off the phone. I looked at a buddy that was sitting with me. I said, have you ever heard of the West Memphis 3? And so he didn't really know either. So I went and started doing a little bit of research. And, you know, slowly but surely it came back to me what the story was. Well, the next day I go into court. Dennis Reardon, who was Damian Nichols' attorney at the time, he pretty famous guy, you know, he represented Barry Bonds in the Balco steroids case. He's based in San Francisco. He was in court. It was a short hearing, nothing much to it. And the ironic thing for me was, is I was like the fourth guy on the totem pole to even cover that one hearing. We had two cops in courts, beat reporters, and then their backup. Well, we had a couple of capital murder cases going on at the time. And then we also had one of our reporters got summoned to to civil court. And so so there was no report. I was the fourth guy on the list, so I went ahead and covered it. Well, in the interim months between that hearing and a series of hearings that began in November of 2008, we lost a couple of reporters, and they naturally, when this West Memphis 3 came up, since I'd covered one whole hearing, obviously was the expert in the office on it now, so I started covering these hearings, and it was really interesting to me because when I came into it, when I walked in the door in November when they started a week-long session, I didn't go into it thinking that these guys were innocent. I just assumed that the prosecutors and the police had gotten it right. You know, most of the time, police and prosecutors do good work. They solve cases, and they put the right people in prison. And so when I walked in the court that day, I was like, okay, I was pretty open-minded, I would say. Actually, not open-minded, but I was definitely not I wasn't going to be swayed by – it would take real arguments to sway me, I guess is the best way to put it. And so as I'm sitting in court, and I mean, these hearings took forever. They lasted a couple of years. What they're called Rule 37 hearings. And basically in these hearings, what was allowed is the judge allowed – just about basically any argument that the defense could make, these guys were innocent. He basically said, okay, I'm going to let you make it. Now, I don't think it would have mattered what they would have argued. I'm pretty sure Judge Burnett was going to decide under almost no circumstance that they were, you know, not going to be, he was going to uphold the convictions no matter what. But it's really interesting because they brought in a slew of high profile experts who testified in the case. And, you know, the first thing that people will say is, well, these were defense-paid, you know, witnesses. And that is true in some instances. Some of these guys were paid, but some of them were not. And they all came to the same universal conclusions. And what, you know, and there's just some, you know, like I'm a pretty pragmatic person. I'm pretty pragmatic when it comes to journalism. And there were just some details about the crime that didn't make sense to me from the very beginning, even when I thought they were guilty. And it's actually small things. And one of those small things that never made sense to me was within 24 hours of the murders, they were already interviewing Damian Nichols as a suspect. And the reason that was is alarming to me, or sounds an alarm bell, is because I've covered a lot of capital murder cases, and this is kind of how it goes. If, you know, take person A, person B. If person A shoots person B and a bunch of people see him do it, then immediately person A is a suspect, right? Or if person A, if there's some overwhelming piece of evidence, like his gun is at the crime scene, his wallet, or if person A goes into a police station and confesses, then they would be a prime suspect. So in this case, you didn't have any of those three elements one day after. And so, and then you know this, what happens after, what happens if you don't have those elements? Is you're going to have to do, you know, you're going to have to do good detective work. You know, you're going to have to analyze evidence. You're going to have to interview witnesses. So the fact that they had honed in on Echols so early was kind of, it was just, it, not only is the word suspicious, it's just weird. It didn't make any sense to me. Just from a, you know, covering these types of things perspective. So I sit in court, they bring in, you know, they start bringing in all these experts. One of the guys they brought in was a guy named Dr. Richard Suverin. Dr. Suverin is the forensic odontologist down in Miami-Dade County in Florida. And his, what made his claim to fame is that he was the odontologist who actually helped to identify Ted Bundy's victims back in the late 1970s through his bite mark evidence. And so he came and testified in this case, and he's also a, and I hate to use these cliche terms, but he is a world-renowned expert in identifying bodies that have been bitten, like in water, you know, by aquatic creatures, because, you know, in Florida, they've got sharks and alligators and everything else. So he is a real expert in, you know, dealing with bodies that have been savaged by animals in water. And so he came in, and he spent a day, and he told the judge, he said, look, these boys were not, you know, they were not sliced up with a knife. He said, there's no bone-piercing injuries to these bodies. And if you ever see the knife that was used, that the prosecutor's claim was used in these crimes, the blade is very long. It's like a Rambo style knife. And I've seen the knife. I've seen it in court before. And there is no way, if you had that knife and you were going to savage three kids the way these guys were alleged to have done, you were going to stab one of them. You're not just going to sit there and scrape them with a little knife. I mean, because that's all they had. They had very superficial wounds like that. And, of course, Richard Suverin's explanation for it was very simple. These are aquatic creatures clawing at the bodies after they died, post-mortem. He said there's very little blood. And, of course, they had all the autopsy photos up on the screen, and they were going through it, you know, very dramatically. And, you know, and even a layman like me, I could look at it and go, okay, yeah, if I'm a knife-wielding killer, I'm going to stab the victims. I'm not going to sit there and scrape on them and not even really cause any injury. So his testimony is very interesting to me. I interviewed him later. You know, he told me flat out, he said in 40 years of working, you know, or 30 years, whatever it was, of working criminal cases, it was one of the craziest cases he had ever seen in his career. And then another guy that testified was a Dr. Michael Bodden. And, of course, Dr. Bodden was the chief medical examiner for the city of New York for 11 years. You'll see him on TV quite a bit. He's a commentator when something, you know, when we have a major catastrophe, like if an airplane goes down or something, he'll come in and talk about, you know, forensic pathology and all that kind of thing. And and he's also written, I think, episodes of CSI and things like that. So he's very well-respected, well-known, one of the most respected forensic pathologists in the world. And he probably in more detail, you know, he went in and, you know, they blew up these autopsy pictures. And, you know, there was a lot of the wounds were triangular in shape. And he said this was very simple because these were turtle bites. And, of course, the prosecutors in this hearing just jumped all over and said, you can't prove there were any turtles in the creek. So in one instance, they brought John Mark Byers, you know, one of the stepfathers, actually one of the stepfathers who was accused of doing, you know, killing the boys at one point. Right. They brought him to the stand, and they only asked him, you know, basically one or two questions, you know, what this place where the bodies were found, what was it called, this specific place? In Robin Hood Hills, what was it called? And he said it was called Turtle Hill because there was a bunch of turtles that congregated right next to that drainage ditch on that hill. All the kids called it that. And so it was also interesting, too, because Dr. Frank Peretti, who is the state medical examiner in Arkansas, he had told Paul Ford back before the original trial started, and here's the thing about Peretti. He actually raises terrapins as a hobby. So he raises turtles, and he told Paul Ford, he allegedly told Paul Ford that he thought that a lot of the wounds on the victims at that time, before the first trial even started, were caused by turtles. Now, when he took the stand during these Rule 37 hearings, okay, Paul Ford took the stand during these Rule 37 hearings and testified to that fact. He said, Dr. Peretti did tell me this, but they didn't think it was significant at the time. And so, but then Dr. Parady did get on the stand, and I will clarify this. He denied that he ever told Paul Ford this. But as I told my editor when I went back to the office, I said, here's the problem with the two statements. First, Paul Ford is an attorney. If he got on the stand and lied about a conversation that he had under oath, he could lose his law license. Dr. Parady can get on the stand and lie about it, and he loses nothing because it's just a conversation to him. So when you look at what each of them were risking in that circumstance, we don't know for sure if it happened or not, but obviously I would probably tend to think that the person who has the most to lose would be the person who's not lying. So anyway, Dr. Bodden, he testified and again, I interviewed him too. Very nice man, very well-respected, well-educated. He told me, he said, there's no way these three guys did this crime the way the prosecutor said. It's simply impossible. He said that knife was not used to do any of these things. And so then they also brought in another guy named Dr. Warner Spitz, and I guess he's kind of like the grandfather of forensic pathologists. And he testified to pretty much the same things. He said that the three boys, he thought that all three of them drowned in the creek. He again, like other forensic pathologists, has no explanation as to why Christopher Byers is organs were pale, what happened to all the blood? Nobody can ever figure out, if this boy bled out, where all the blood went, because there was no blood recovered from the scene. That's also a common misconception that I've run across through the years, is that they did find blood, but that is not true. They did some luminol testing weeks after the bodies were found. They found traces of some chemicals out there, but they were never able to find anything that they could bring into a court of law. And so with all this scientific evidence piling up, a woman named Dr. Janice Ophoven, she's based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's a foremost pediatric forensic pathologist. Her testimony was really, really interesting to me because the other three testified about the wounds to the bodies, and that made sense to me to a certain degree. What she testified to really strikes at the heart of the case. Because everybody always talks about Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. giving 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 confessions, and I've heard every one of them that they've recorded. They played them all in court. And the thing about it is, the one thing he's consistent about in his confessions, he always says that the boys were sodomized. He says they were raped. And so, to me, that's a big detail because, like in his first confession, he got a bunch of things wrong. And everybody knows the story, that he misidentified the time and the place, and he misidentified which boys were which, and he didn't even tell them that they were tied with their own shoelaces. He said they were bound with ropes and all this and that. We know all these details. What's interesting to me about Dr. Ophoven's testimony is she said that these boys were not sexually assaulted. And this is very graphic, but, they put up three blown up pictures of the boys' anuses in the courtroom. And she systematically went through and said, look, there's no damage, there's no bruising to any of their anuses at all. There's no semen present, and none of them had an STD. Those are the three tests that you use to determine if somebody has been sodomized or sexually assaulted. And she said, it's impossible. Because even the prosecutor at one point asked her, he said, is it possible to sodomize a child and leave no evidence of it? And she said, yes, it's possible. She said, but it would be virtually impossible to do it to two or three of them. She said, there's no way that could happen. She said, if there were multiple partners, multiple victims, she said, it's simply impossible. There would be some evidence that it happened. And so that right there, and even Dr. Parady, when he testified later in the hearing, admitted the same thing. He said, while he left the impression with the jurors in the original trials that they were sexually assaulted, he definitively said during the hearing, without the presence of any of those things, then they probably weren't sexually assaulted. So that was a big key for me, because for his confession to be true and honest, confessions are supposed to give clarity to crimes. A police officer walks into a room, there's a murder victim here, there's a lamp, knocked over here, the bed is in a certain position. And then they're trying to put all these clues together to figure out exactly what happened and when it happened. And usually when somebody comes in and confesses to a murder like that, they say, well, the reason the lamp was knocked open was because of this. The reason that the bed was in this position was because of that. In Jesse's confession, he just creates a bunch of more questions. I mean, It's almost like his first couple of confessions just were kind of like they were fitting a square peg into a round hole of what they knew. But then with the advent of modern DNA and all this other stuff, you know, and also just better forensic pathology, you know, we've really advanced in the last 20 years in our interpretations and how we interpret evidence and how we analyze it and use it in court. So I think that these guys are very lucky that this happened when it did. And, you know, and I tell people this all the time, you know, I listened to the scientific stuff in court and it was very impressive to me, but still, I still clung. I was like, okay, because I literally have covered cases where people have walked scot-free. They committed the crime, but there wasn't one scintilla of evidence that the police and prosecutors could generate to get a conviction. And so
let me ask a question, George. Let me get a question in here, George. Thanks for let me ask this question. What we have to talk about is if you've gone to this hearing in 2008 and all this information comes out, but what you do talk about at the very beginning of your book that we've completely not spoken about is how this all came to be with Jesse Miskelly's confession. And you also talk about Victoria Hutchinson and her son Aaron. So all of the information that went into first targeting Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin. So what happens is that, again, like you say, you're just a teenager when this happens, but in this, all of this other evidence comes out. The West Memphis 3 is a phenomena. Once you see the documentaries and the films that come out, the case changes. The entire focus of the nation looks at this case because they see the confession and they see the coverage that was allowed. Somehow this Judge Burnett and authorities, defense attorneys and families, allowed, thankfully, as you say, Damien Eccles said, that saved his life, that coverage and this phenomena, this support that came afterwards. But very interesting, some of the stuff that you go through is exactly how the police, you talk about Detective Meeks, and you talk about how exactly they did focus on Damien Eccles and how they used this confession in the very beginning, that it was so weak, this confession, as you say, that he had the time wrong and details very significant, like rope rather than shoelaces, that they had to go to the authorities. So as you do, tell us about how they went to the authorities initially and couldn't get an arrest warrant and what they were told and what they did. And tell us about Victoria Hutchinson and her role and her son's role in this early in the investigation.
Well, what happened was is they brought Jesse in on June 3rd. They brought him in around 10 o'clock in the morning, and he spent 4 or 5 hours with detectives. They only recorded, you know, a few minutes of it toward the very end. And basically what they did is they coerced him into giving a confession. And I use the term confession very loosely because if you ever – the thing that changed for me in this case was when I had an attorney ask me if I had ever read his confession, the first one.
That's right.
And I hadn't. I had not. And I was like, okay. So I went back to my – or actually it was an attorney's girlfriend who came in from Philadelphia to go to one of these hearings on their vacation. And so that night I went back to my office. I read the confession. I could not believe it. I was stunned because all the details were wrong. And so when they were able to elicit this confession from Jesse back on June 3rd, 1993, they took it to a magistrate to get warrants to arrest Eccles, Baldwin, and Ms. Kelly. The magistrate read it over and was like, no, you can't arrest anybody because all these details are wrong. Well, they bring Jesse back to the police station, and they record another 9, 10, 12 minutes or whatever, and then he cleans up some of those details, and so then it's enough to where they can go and arrest all these three guys. So his confession was so bad to begin with, they couldn't even issue arrest warrants. So and how Victoria Hutchinson ties into this, Victoria Hutchinson, when the three boys who died, she had a son named Aaron who was friends with the three. And he claimed that he had actually watched the murders take place. And so the police interviewed him multiple times, and each time he told a different story, a fanciful story. But for weeks and weeks and weeks, the police were convinced that he knew something. Well, they just kept talking to him, and then eventually they got to the point where they realized that he didn't know anything. Well, during this time, they were still trying to get Damien Eccles, and so what they did is they got Victoria Hutchinson, Aaron's mother, they got her to lure him over to her house, and they had placed a bugging device in the house. And what they told her to do was to put books like satanic, you know, like, or not satanic, but just like occult-related books out and start talking to him about it, try to get him to talk about this stuff. Well, Vicky told the police that Damien came over, and she said within 10 minutes, she could tell he had nothing to do with his crime. He was just a scared kid. There's no way he had anything to do with it. Well, the police told her that wasn't good enough. They needed to tie him to the occult. And the ironic thing was is that Vicky, her son Aaron, a lot of times was babysat by Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. See, and that's another little element that a lot of people don't realize is that Jason and Damien were friends. They were not friends with Jesse. They knew him. They didn't hang out with him. They didn't know him. And so that's how Jesse kind of creeps into this picture is, you know, the police are constantly picking kids up in this trailer park, trying to interview them, trying to get, you know, just trying to find some lead. So, you know, they sweep up Jesse. And here's the thing. He was at Victoria Hutchinson's house the morning that they went and got him the day he confessed. And the reason that's interesting is because they had that bugging device underneath the house. And Vicky Hutchinson told me this to my face. She goes, if they really thought that Jesse was a killer involved in these three murders, why would they let him stay in my house with my son? Why wouldn't they tell me to keep my son away from him? And I said, that's a good point. And so when the police, when they talked to her, they said that about this whole meeting with Damien, she said, they told her that they thought she was lying. And then she goes, well, you've got the audio from that device you guys put in my house. So what does it say? And they said, well, it was incomprehensible. We can't hear it. We can't hear anything. So they finally tell her, you know, she's facing a credit card fraud charge. And, you know, basically she claims that she was threatened. And so then she had to make up a story about going to a satanic S-spot with Eccles and Miss Kelly. And here's the thing. I've interviewed her face-to-face before. She told me to my face that she lied. She testified at Jesse's trial that she had attended this thing, and on the juror notebooks afterwards, you know, when jurors were writing down, you know, compelling reasons to convict, one of them was her testimony. So to say that she had no impact on this case, because I've heard that said too, is ludicrous, because part of this sensationalism about this satanic panic that happened around here was because of testimony like hers, and she directly testified to it. And so go ahead.
Sorry, what we're forgetting to say, though, that it's not that she's innocent to this or the police are innocent in this, is that this stems from his probation officer, Stephen Jones, I believe, and his boss.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that, because that's very interesting where this came from as well.
Yeah, Jerry Driver and Stephen Jones were, I don't think he was a probation, I think he was like a social worker who had worked with Eccles.
Right.
He knew of him, and they both knew of him. And they were dead convinced that there was an upcropping of satanic worship among the youth in West Memphis during this time. They thought that this was a real phenomenon, and that they were going to start sacrificing, you know, they'd been sacrificing animals. They thought they were going to start sacrificing children. And, of course, Damien, he'll admit to you, he was very troubled at the time when he was, you know, he was 18 years old, and, you know, he had dropped out of high school, and he had been diagnosed with various, you know, mental disorders at the time. And so he would meet with these guys, and he would say things to them like, you know, yeah, I'm going to have a kid, and I'm going to sacrifice it, you know. And of course, he told me when he was on death row in 2010 when I interviewed him, he told me, he goes, I was just messing with these guys, but they were taking me seriously, and I didn't realize it. I was too stupid to understand what was the gravity of what was going on. And so when they find the bodies, you know, these two guys are the first, they literally on the ditch bank are like, Damien Eccles did this. He is involved. Trust me. And so that's what led I believe it was Lieutenant Sutterberry is the first one who went to Eccles' house. I'm pretty sure about that the next day. And either Jerry Driver or Stephen Jones, I believe it was Stephen Jones, was with him. They went straight to Eccles' house, took a picture of him wearing a Portland Trailblazers NBA basketball team T-shirt, and from that point on, he was a suspect. And it was all based on what these guys were telling people. And there was no evidence at all that this had even happened. So they honed in on him early based on someone's opinion, not any facts that they had gleaned from the crime scene.
You also, maybe you can tell us how this works as well, because they take this speculative information from Jones and Driver, you say, but then they find, then it seems like they're planting ideas, and you describe how this confession actually went down. So if he's asked a question and he doesn't know the answer, tell us what this process was as you found out.
It's basically like this. They would ask him a question, like, let's say, when did you encounter the boys? And Jesse would say, well, it was early in the morning, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. And they'd say, okay, well, they'd keep going. Well, then they would go, was it 8 or was it 10? And he'd go, yeah. I mean, the next answer is like, yeah. And then they'd say, well, maybe it was closer to noon. And he would say, sure. And so basically what was happening is they were just moving the dial for Jesse. They were just steering him in the right direction. They were leading him. And again, you know, if anybody, you know, who's in this business, you know, in journalism or in the police detective business, I mean, law enforcement, you know that when somebody's giving you a confession, they're going to sit you down and they're going to give you details that you did not have. It's going to be clear because the person who did it knows how it happened. They don't have to be confused because they were there. And the problem with Jesse is he is very confused the whole time. And here's the thing. Jesse was in court for a lot of these hearings, and so was Jason Baldwin. So I got to interact with both of them quite a bit. And I'm telling you that when you meet Jesse, you are meeting a person of extreme low intelligence. And I don't say that to be mean or belittle him in any way. But his whole life, when he was in school, his entire academic career, what little of it there was, he had a history of not being able to comprehend things in school. You know, he has a low IQ. He's easily manipulated. And it's quite obvious. I mean, he was in court. You know, his defense attorney, Dan Stidham, the original defense attorney, told me, several years ago that, Jesse didn't even realize that he was actually an attorney. He thought that his own attorney, his defense attorney, was a cop. He didn't even realize the difference between a cop and a defense attorney. And so he said it was really hard dealing with him. And Dan told me straight up, he said, that kid, he said, there is no way he was at that crime scene. He said he didn't know anything of it. The only reason that his confessions got better, you know, over time is because he went through the trial, he got more details. And he said Jesse legitimately thought at some point they were just going to finally figure out that he had nothing to do with it, and they were just going to let him go. And then finally he figured out that that wasn't going to happen, and that's why he didn't testify at the Eccles-Baldwin trial. And I'll give you another interesting little nugget that's not talked about a lot. Vicki Hutchinson, she didn't testify at the Eccles-Baldwin trial either because she was hopped up on drugs, and the prosecutors at the time deemed that she would be a liability if she were, you know, brought into court. And so So they put her in a hotel. She told me that they put her in a hotel in Memphis and told her just to stay away. Why would you have if you had a legitimate witness who could say that Damien Eccles was at a satanic S-spot in Turl, Arkansas, how in the world does that person not make it to the stand?
You also have them taking that information and their initial theory that there was this satanic ritual, and you get that from, again, you discredit this expert as he has been discredited. His name is Griffin. So tell us a little bit about his non-background and then what exactly he does say. And then what I was going to get you to say is that how does this information and their theory about Satanism and this expert witness Griffin, that information, how does that tie in, do you think, with the first, especially, version and the second version of the confession in terms of those elements where Miss Kelly is talking about, you know, the emasculating the one of the boys and stuff like that. Tell us how you think that that information and that speculation is incorporated into those confessions.
Well, Dale Griffiths, I mean, he's a fraud. I mean, there's no other way to say it. How this guy was ever, sworn in as an expert witness, it is beyond unconscionable. I mean, this guy has no credentials at all. He was a police officer in Ohio, and he decided that he was going to become an expert on the occult. For some reason, I can't remember if it was 2020 or Dateline or some actually pretty respectable news program decided to put him on as an expert at one point because they couldn't find one around the country. I think it was in the late 80s because there were none. Nobody was an expert in the occult or Satanism or practices of Satanism because there was no need to be, from a law enforcement perspective. But then in the late 80s,
right,
like we talked about before, that satanic panic started setting in. Kids started, reading Stephen King and dressing like goths and listening to Metallica, which all that stuff pretty normal today. But back then it was like, oh man, what's going on with our youth, And so this guy somehow, because he was on one show or two shows, kind of became an expert. The backstory is that he actually he called himself Dr. Dale Griffiths, but he actually got his, diploma from a diploma mill in California, meaning he just sent him money and they sent him a diploma. So he took no classes. He has no expertise in this area. And so he basically got on the stand and then he was just testifying to all sorts of just crazy facts, about the day, May 5th having certain meaning or preference for Satan worshipers, and that the number three, the three victims and the three killers, that there was all, this was all symbiotic, And he also talked about like the blood of a young child, and then the sacrifice, because, Christopher Byers was, emasculated during all this. Interesting, and going back to the forensic pathology part of that, though, there is one interesting note about the emasculation that I found interesting. If somebody was going to cut that part of his body off with a knife, you would expect there to be a bone piercing wound somewhere in the groin area. There is not.
Right.
So the theory that, that this was that the emasculation occurred post mortem by a turtle or another aquatic creature makes a lot more sense just from a scientific standpoint. So, but anyway, back to Dale Griffiths. He made all these wild claims on the stand, and I mean, I can't even believe a responsible juror would have taken this guy seriously. I mean, but they did. This is the funny thing, Dan. After the fact, this was the motive, that they created, opening and closing arguments. They bring this clown onto the stand to testify. Okay, so they make all of this argument that this is a satanic killing. Now, when you talk to them, oh, no, that wasn't the motive. That's what they say now. Oh, no, that wasn't the motive. That was just one possible motive. I'm sitting here going, you guys based your entire case on this fool and a bunch of things that he said, because, of course, since then he's written all sorts of conspiracy theories about 9/11, all sorts of stuff he's just a whack job. So anyway, but yeah, that's pretty much how that went down. And again, Victoria Hutchinson, if she was she could provide a critical link, right after Griffiths testifies, you would put her on the stand and say, okay, well, he just said this has all the hallmarks of a satanic killing. Now tell us about you attending this S-spot with Eccles. And it didn't happen because she didn't attend one because it was all a lie.
When you talk about DNA advances in the mid-2000s and by 2008, again, what do the officials say, the prosecutors say, the attorney general say about DNA advances and the tests? And you talk about two hairs found and who it points to, two different people. And I'll ask you about what you make of Hobb. Anyway, we'll talk about these two people and the hairs that are associated with them. Tell us about the DNA advances and what it says to the courts, if anything.
Well, it, like you said, in the mid-2000s, you know, DNA testing got a whole lot better. And it was, you know, I always tell people there's the moment when I was greatly suspicious these guys didn't do it. But then I was driving home one night, it was raining really hard, and there was a moment I was almost definitively sure. And it's because of this. Around the country, there are not just – the West Memphis 3 are not unique. There are lots of cases out there where people are in prison, but, you know, people on the outside think that they might be innocent of the crime, and some of them are. And so an interesting phenomenon happened, started happening in the mid-2000s. This DNA testing got a whole lot better. Well, if you're innocent, you obviously want more – you know, you want more DNA testing, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's everything. And so that's the – but let's say but here's the other side of the coin. Let's say people presume you're guilty or innocent, but you did do it. Guess what you don't want? You don't want people testing DNA, right? So an interesting phenomenon started around the country when this happened. You know, there's a whole bunch of people who wanted it and a whole bunch of people who didn't. Now, the interesting thing about the West Memphis 3 case is when they started doing this fine mitochondrial DNA testing on some of these hairs and other biological specimens that were found at the crime scene, you know, we think about these three guys as a unit, but they're really not. Legally, they're three separate people. They have three separate defense teams. And here's the thing. What drove the West Memphis 3 is people all thought these three guys were innocent of this crime. But if I'm an attorney, you know, when they go to submit the paperwork to get these DNA tests done, you got to remember one thing. If Jesse – let's just say in a vacuum. Maybe Jesse did have something to do with the murders. Maybe he was there. Maybe Eccles involved him or not. Maybe he was there and took part in it. So an attorney had to sit Eccles and Baldwin down and say, look, if we agree to this testing and Jesse's confessed to this crime, is it possible his DNA was there? Maybe. I mean, most people would think not, but I have to think that an attorney would have taken those guys into a room somewhere and said, look, if we do this, you know, you're going to have to be dead. Sure, the other two weren't there because it won't matter from a legal standpoint if they find their DNA at the crime scene. But from a public perception standpoint, if like Jesse's DNA is found there, they're going to think that all three of you were there. You see what I'm getting at, Dan?
Yeah.
And so for me, when I was driving home one night, when they all three unilaterally didn't care, said test, you know, that was all they said, test everything. So then I thought, okay, you know, you're jumping even further than just yourself because of, and so. When I heard that, I was like, okay, yeah, these guys, it's more likely they're innocent. And they tested every biological specimen that was collected at the crime scene, and none of them tested positive for the three men who were in prison for those crimes. Now, in a ligature that bound Michael Moore, they found a hair. And they tested the hair, and the hair it fit the DNA profile for Terry Hobbs, who was Stevie Branch's stepdad at the time. And that was interesting. It's not condemning, obviously, because, you know, secondary hair transfer happens. You know, those kids were in and out of each other's houses. It's very possible that he just picked up a hair. What was made it more interesting, though, was next to the tree stump where the bodies were dumped, they found another hair, and it belonged to a guy named David Jacoby. Jacoby is Hobbs' alibi witness. And Jacoby swears up and down he was not with Terry Hobbs when the murders occurred. So to have a stepfather's hair and his alibi witness DNA both at the crime scene, that's a very – I mean, you know, if I'm a detective and I'm – you know, because when a kid disappears, it's almost – the FBI statistics will tell you. It is a parent that has done something to the kid, a parent or step-parent. And sure. So – The natural suspects in the case should have been from the beginning the parents, just because of statistics. And Terry Hobbs was never even interviewed during the original investigation, which is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
And he not only was he was not interviewed, he was the custodial parent of Stevie Branch when the boy disappeared. His wife was at work. And so right there, I mean, I don't understand. Why would the police just bring him in and say, okay, well, give us an outline of what happened that afternoon. You know, where were you guys at? What were you doing? And so none of that happened. And Pam Hobbs told me to my face that she didn't find out her son was missing that night until 9:30. When he came to pick her up, he walked past her, went to a payphone, and called the police and reported him missing. She goes out to the car not knowing all this and sees her daughter Amanda, and she says, Amanda, where's your brother? And she goes, oh, he's missing, Mama. And so she had no idea up until 9:30 that night. Well, the other two kids had been reported missing hours earlier, and Dana Moore and John Mark Byers and their families and friends were out in the neighborhood looking for them, you know, around 8:30 that night. So it's very suspicious, you know, and I've told people this. You know, there's been a lot of people have cast an eye towards Terry Hobbs thinking that he had something to do with these murders. It would still be difficult to convict him in a court of law, however. There's still you would still have to have more evidence. But you can make a way better case against him than you could the West Memphis 3, for sure.
You talk about some of the things that Hobbs has said, and he has tried to say that he was with John Byers at a certain time. Tell us about this and what Byers says, what Hobbs says about that.
Well, what's interesting is that that Terry Hobbs was never on anybody's radar till 2007 when this DNA came out. Well, Natalie
right.
Maines, the lead singer from the Dixie Chicks, she's a big West Memphis 3 supporter. She donated money to their cause. Well, she had a rally
right.
at the Capitol steps in Little Rock, and during that rally, she said that, you know, hey, you know, the police and prosecutors need to go after the real West Memphis 3 killer, Terry Wayne Hobbs. Well, Terry Hobbs decided he was going to sue her in federal court. Well, that was the worst mistake he's ever made, and he told me this. Because what that did is it opened him up to discovery where they could bring him in and say, okay, because here's the thing. The first tenet of any lawsuit is you have to prove that she's lying, that she's making a false statement. Well,
right.
Then you know what? Then so it opened him up. Well, the problem is that you can go on YouTube and look at some of the interviews. He forgets details about what happened. And I've heard people make so many excuses, and I'm sitting there going, your stepson, on the afternoon he gets murdered, you're going to remember every single detail of what happened that afternoon for the rest of your life. Okay? That's just common, you know, sense. And so you can get on there and look at these competing stories that he's told. And so the long and the short of it is during this process, they interviewed John Mark Byers because Terry claimed that he was with John Mark Byers and Dana Moore. Well, John Mark Byers, this is an alarm bell for him. He's like, wait a minute. He goes, no, and I've interviewed John about this. There is no, he was not with me. He was not with us. We did not see Terry Hobbs. He says, I did not even know Terry Hobbs that night. I met Terry Hobbs later on. And then they kind of became friends for a little while. And so that was the first one. He signed a sworn affidavit saying he was not with me that night. And Terry was very adamant with John. They talked about it. He said, no, don't you remember I was with you? And he goes, no, you weren't. And so so that was an alarming. Well, then John Byers had a really bizarre conversation with him. They just started talking about, like, you know, like maybe the person who killed the three kids was like a druggie, you know, drugged out of their mind, and they just went in, and it was an accident, didn't mean to do it. And, you know, John was telling Terry the story. He goes, yeah, he goes, that's exactly right. He said, that person wouldn't be a monster. It'd be like, you know, being a drunk driver. You didn't get drunk and mean to kill three people. It just happened. And so
yeah.
When John was going through this story with him, and Terry's like that, he told me, he said, I couldn't believe he was saying this stuff. He's like, how could this person not be a monster? What are you talking about? So at that point, then, of course, John Mark Byers very publicly turned on Terry and said, look, this guy obviously had something to do with my son's murder and his son's murder, because there's no way, you know, he would keep trying to convince all of us that he was with us looking for them when he was not. And he would never, you know, tell a story where, you know, the guy that did it was kind of like a drunk driver, not a monster, you know. So that all came out of that lawsuit, and it's also ironic, too, because at the end of the lawsuit, the federal judge in the case actually ordered Terry Hobbs to pay Natalie Maines $20,000 to cover her legal fees. So,
interesting.
Which Terry Hobbs didn't. I mean, you know, but that wasn't even the point of the exercise anyway. And Natalie Maines has told me that they were thrilled whenever when Hobbs decided to do this because it opened him up. They could finally interview him, and they could get these competing stories about where he was at, what he was doing, who he was interacting with. Because that's the thing, is Terry Hobbs tells one story on this side, and everybody else tells a different story over here.
You talk about, too, that that out of the three victims, it's very interesting that his stepson was the one that was more, well, you could tell us, he was more assaulted, and there was a belt buckle, maybe. Tell us a little bit about what you conclude or what you speculate about this.
One thing about it, and I saw a lot of these autopsy pictures, and they were gruesome, to say the least. The one thing I noticed, and this was even before I had, you know, gone through all, you know, the process of thinking these guys were guilty or innocent. But, you know, as I'm sitting in the courtroom and they're showing all these autopsy pictures of the three victims, when they started showing Stevie's, he was more damaged. Like this, he had this wound to his face. It was like a gash. And as I was looking at it, I was thinking, that's exactly what a belt buckle would look like if it went across somebody's face. And this had nothing to do with thinking that Terry Hobbs did it or Eccles did it or whoever. I was just looking at the picture going, that wound was caused by a belt buckle. You can just see it on his face. And, you know, and he was really badly beaten. And, you know, like Michael Moore had some, you know, he had a major contusion to the head. Hope I'm using the right medical term there. And basically, you know, the way it was described in court was this kid was just knocked out and then thrown in the ditch and then he drowned because he was unconscious. And so he wasn't, you know, he had a few superficial scrapes and wounds, like probably from being drugged through the woods to the creek, you know, something like that. And then Christopher Byers had defensive wounds to his hands, according to the autopsy reports. So he fought back. And so to me, I was sitting here going, okay, you know, I cover a lot of crimes. There's always a motive in a crime. And the fulcrum of motivation in this crime was Stevie Branch. He was the one beaten the most. He was the one that was attacked the most. So that's when, you know, you start looking at the things, you know, in his orbit. You know, he's got a stepdad, you know, a violent stepdad who has a lengthy criminal history, you know, and actually has a history of beating and tormenting that kid. I mean, I've heard that from Pam Hobbs' sister. I've heard that from Pam Hobbs herself. She told me one time it was literally like he hated him when, you know, speaking about Terry with Stevie. And she said he would never call him, she would never call him by his name. He would just call him the boy or the stepson. And so it was almost like an attempt to dehumanize him, you know. And so anyway, I thought it was, you know, pretty interesting, you know, looking at those pictures and trying to determine the motivation of the person who was doing it. And it's pretty obvious. The problem is that the emasculation of Christopher Byers, that's when everybody turned their head. You know, everybody went to him because it must have been something with him. But then when you come to the reasonable conclusion that it probably happened as a result of turtle predation or animal predation post-mortem, you know, and that's very common. And I, people will try to refute that. And I'm sitting here going, you know, I'm not much of a hunter, but I've been out in the woods before. You come across a dead animal, what's the first thing that you'll see missing? It's genitals, you know, because other animals, that's the first thing they go for, especially dogs, canines. So, and there were, you know, wild coyotes in that area too. I mean, very possible a wild coyote decided to chew on him for a while. And I hate to say things like that, but that's just the facts of the case. So, yeah, I think that if you look at the autopsy photos, for sure, Stevie Branch, definitely the most viciously attacked of the three.
Didn't you say, don't you write about someone involved in this case? Is it Judge Burnett actually raising turtles? Did you talk
actually,
about that
Dr.
actually Perretti. Raises?
It was
Dr.
Perretti
himself.
Perretti.
Yeah, yes. Yes, I just wanted to mention that, and I forgot to mention at that time. You add that, but you don't make any other statements that Perretti, who was adamant about his position, despite the other three expert testimony, expert witness testifying that there was this animal predation and there was proof of that, and there certainly was no proof of sexual assault. You also talk about, I want you to mention what that Peretti was raising turtles, so in that you infer that he should have known better, but also there was this intimation or more than that about forced oral sex. So tell us a little bit about that and how they came to that conclusion and how it was refuted.
Okay, that's actually pretty interesting. I guess to start with, yes, Dr. Peretti raises terrapins, or he claimed to raise terrapins when he testified in court. And like I said earlier, he is alleged to have told Paul Ford, Jason Baldwin's original defense attorney, even before the original trials, that he thought some of the wounds could or were definitely turtle predation marks. He said the same thing to Paul Ford. And here, this is what's interesting, Dan, is because like witnesses come into a court, they testify, they go out. So, and they never hear what other witnesses testify. Well, Paul Ford came in 2008 and says, yes, Dr. Peretti told me back in 1993 that there were a lot of triangular wounds on the bodies, and these triangular wounds were probably caused by turtles predating on the bodies. So then he goes out. Well, then a year later, Dr. Spitz, Dr. Bonin, Dr. Subrin take the stand, and they say the exact same thing that Paul Ford said Dr. Frank Peretti told him almost 15 years before that. So it's interesting to me because I'm sitting there, you know, they weren't in the courtroom to hear it. It's not like they can just be coordinating all this stuff up. So, and like I said, and Paul Ford has no motivation to do that because he can lose his law license over something like that. So he wouldn't lie about it. And, you know, as far as Dr. Peretti, he talks a lot about raising these turtles and how much he liked doing it. So he should have known. Now, the second part of your question is very interesting because in the original trials, Dr. Peretti never definitively said the boys were sexually assaulted because obviously the three tenets that we talked about previously were not met. But he left the impression on the jurors that they could have been by making some statements similar to what, like you said, there was a bruise to one of the boy's ears. And he made the statement in court that that could be a sign of forced fellatio. And the problem is there has never been a documented instance where a bruise to an ear like that and where the bruise was and how it was, how the manner of the bruise, that would lead that was a because of a forced fellatio circumstance. And so Dr. Peretti back in, I want to say it was 2007 maybe, he actually met with some of these forensic pathologists that testified and some other ones that were consulting on the case. They all met and they went over all their findings and he readily admitted he wasn't sure where he got that determination because that was one thing that the forensic pathologists, the others that they were very, very keen about was this, you know, forced fellatio thing in this bruise because they never heard of anything like that. And Dr. Oppoven on the stand said that Peretti told them during this meeting that he would get back to them. He would come up, he would give them, he would show them exactly where he came up with all this stuff and he would get back to them. Well, she said, and this was 2 years after the fact when she was on the stand, she said that never happened. He never came back and told them where he found this. And she said it's not even a matter of like for court because, you know, forensic pathologists are scientists. And they're genuinely interested in other pathology performed by others. And so it's kind of one of those things. They were just interested in it. And if it really was a thing, they wanted to know about it. Well, he never was able to prove where he got it. He never said where he got this information from. So, once again, there's that one bruise, you know, that must mean that these boys were forced to do something they didn't want to do. But once again, not validated in any type of science.
The authorities maintain their position that they got the guys, whether they have DNA or not. And so, obviously, they're not going to regard any new information, or they wouldn't consider it new information when it's regarding Terry Hobbs or anyone else. Tell us how they, what that necessitates. This Allard plea is a guilty plea. Tell us about this Allard plea and a little bit about, again, what I thought was very interesting when you talk about Jesse Miskelly in the first, after for this trial of Eccles and Baldwin, he would not testify. He would not testify, so it created a problem a little bit for them prosecutorially at that trial. But you say that also that Baldwin was not as interested as Eccles with this Alford plea. So tell us about that.
During the first trials, they were pretty convinced that Jesse would have to testify to get a conviction on Eccles and Baldwin. When you're watching Paradise Lost, the first one, the prosecutors tell families of the victims that without him, 50-50 shot. Of course, they lucked out because somehow, some way, that confession was brought into the jury room after the trial portion was over and they were when they were considering the case in the jury room. There's lots of allegations of juror misconduct and that it was actually brought into the jury room. So they got the prosecution got the benefit of the confession without the deficit of having to fight it on the stand. Because here's the thing, mm-hmm. The reason that Jesse didn't testify is because at this point he was totally recanting his confession. He said that he was coerced by police and that he would not take the stand. And it got to a point where he was so erratic anyway. A lot of people have told me that the prosecutors wouldn't have put him on the stand because of the simple thing. They would see how erratic he was, and they would know that this whole thing was a sham. And so they kept him off the stand, but they were able to get the benefit of it because it was brought into the jury room. So, yes, Jesse didn't testify. And here's the other thing people don't realize a lot of. Jason Baldwin was offered a sweetheart deal if he would testify against Eccles in the same trial. He was offered, I think, 7 or 8 years if he would just testify, right, and then he would be out of prison. And he flatly told them no. And the reason he said he told them no was because he didn't do it. He knew Damien had nothing to do with it. And he said, "You guys are just trying to railroad us. We're going to have our day in court." So so when the Alford plea comes down, Patrick Banca and the Arkansas Attorney General at the time, Dustin McDaniel, their college or their law school buddies, and Banca was working with the West Memphis 3 defense teams, and Dustin McDaniel was getting ready to run for governor, and there was this West Memphis 3 case has just been hanging over the state for a long time. It's been a blight, and so they met and they started talking about an Alford plea. And this is like a no contest plea where a defendant walks into court and says, "Hey, I'm innocent of this crime, but it is possible the state could have enough evidence to convict me of it if they decided to." So they give the Alford plea August 19th, 2011. Well, before that, Baldwin wasn't going to take it. He said he would spend another year or two in prison. He didn't care, and fight in court because he hears this is what was going to happen, and this is the reason why Benka and Dustin McDaniel got together. They got together with the prosecutor Scott Ellington. This is why they hammered this deal out, because there was going to be a new judge in the case, Judge David Laser. That same year, 2011, in December, they were going to have an evidentiary hearing where all this stuff was going to be considered. He was going to order a new trial. There is no doubt about it, and even the prosecutors admitted to all this, and they were going to be exonerated, and then they were going to turn around and sue the state of Arkansas for millions of dollars. And so this was just a saving face move by everybody involved. They wanted to stop them from being able to sue the state. They wanted to – and the other problem was once they were exonerated in court, then they would have to reopen the investigation into the case and actually find out who actually did this. So they didn't want to go through all that rigmarole. They decided it's time to put a stamp on this. Let's get this thing over with. So they made the deal. Of course, Eccles and Miss Kelly were on board from the word go. Jason took him about a week or two. He's like, or several days at least. He said, I just don't want to do this. I'm going to fight. But then one of his attorneys told him, he said, "Look, your friend is on death row. they could start executing. At that point, they hadn't executed anybody in 6 years, but they could start executing people again, and he would be in line to be executed. So you need to make a decision to help save his life. And so, and that's exactly what happened. Jason agreed to the deal, and then those guys walked free.
You talk about the support to raise money for this and the people involved, and you talk about people like Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder, and then the secret person, the bigger supporter that you find out later is Peter Jackson from Lord of the Rings fame. You were at this support rally, and you did have, like we mentioned, the incredible access you had. You spoke to everyone. You met at that time Lori Eccles as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about your experience speaking to everybody involved and how things had sort of – yeah, just tell us a little bit about that and what your treatment was by some of the people that were involved, at least in the support of West Memphis 3.
That was usually treated me pretty well. One thing I always did is I kept a little bit of separation. Eddie Vedder would come into town, the lead singer for Pearl Jam, those Paradise Lost documentary filmmakers, Joe and Bruce, they would come into town. Then of course they were a little bit different because they're kind of more like me, more trying to get a story out. Johnny Depp, I've run into him a couple of times, nice guy. But I always try to keep that, like a professional line, even with Lori, I like her personally, I always try to keep it straight. I wrote a couple of stories that she didn't like. She told me flat out, she didn't like them. And I was fine with that, because that's what you do as a journalist. If everybody's mad, then you've probably done your job the right way.
What didn't she like?
Just some things that she didn't care for, and this was several years ago. Some of the phraseology I would use, every now and then I would use the word child killers, and I get it. And I understand why that would upset somebody, especially if you think they're not. But the problem is that even at that time, this was before they were released. You have to use. At that time they were convicted of a crime, and no matter my own personal belief in it, I still had to be a journalist and write about it. And that's the other thing I always love when people say, a true journalist is never biased and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there going, it's not biased. A journalist, it's not a bias to seek the truth. And when you find it, to accept it. And that, any good journalist should do that. I or you or whoever else should not think just because, we find a truth contrary to what we believe, we should change our mind. And there are two sides to every story, but sometimes one side is right and the other side's wrong, And sure. So anyway, that's the way I kind of approached it. But I saw Lori and Damien and Johnny Depp in April in Little Rock. I actually ran into them quite literally. They had a rally to stop the 8 executions that were going to happen in Arkansas. And the two of them came down for the rally, or the three of them. And they were just – I was literally at the Capitol steps. There was media everywhere, at least 1,000 protesters out there. And I look over next to some steps, and there the three of them are just standing there with a couple bodyguards, nobody talking to them in any way. So I just walked right over there, shook hands with them. Lori gave me a hug, asked them how they were doing. And then, of course, the media throngs come running over as soon as they saw me there. And then, of course, went right into reporter mode. I was standing right next to Damien. I started interviewing him, and getting all his thoughts about being back in Arkansas and all this other stuff. There was a lot of famous people connected to this. Amy Berg did the West of Memphis documentary. I met with her. It kind of gave her the down low on the whole case. She came to Jonesboro one Saturday. I keep it straight up. I tell people all the time, I've asked questions to presidents and stuff like that. So I don't get the stars in my eyes when I see somebody like that, I guess.
You talk about your conversations with Jason Baldwin and Damien Eccles. And first we'll talk about the conversations you had with Jason Baldwin. What's particularly interesting that you people just assume that the treatment in jail was brutal, but I've never heard any details of the treatment of the West Memphis Three in prison. You spoke with Jason Baldwin. He told you some frightening things. Tell us what he said to you about his treatment in jail, how it began and how it changed as perception changed about their guilt, but still what he endured in prison.
Well, when he first got there, I mean, like when he walked in the door first day, he said he started hearing the catcalls. And, you know, I can tell you this and everybody listening to this, a lot of the things you hear about prison, they're absolutely true. You know, there's a lot of sexual slavery that goes on there. And he told me that he was not going to submit to sexual slavery. He just wasn't going to do it. And so he fought back. And he got beat up so bad many times, he said he thought he was going to die. I mean, broken bones, but he would not yield to their demands in prison. And eventually, it got to the point, and Jason's not a big guy. You know, he's thin, he's small, but by all accounts, he's a pretty tough guy. And it got to the point where they respected him. You know, they weren't going to keep messing with him because they knew he was going to fight every time. And so they started respecting him, and then as the details of the case became more known, then they realized that he was an innocent guy in there, and most of those guys are not innocent. So it was very shocking to them to see a guy, you know, work as hard as he did. He took college classes, ended up getting his GED in there. You know, even when he got out, he had a lot of college credits. So he's gone on and went to school. In fact, I don't know for sure if he's still on this path, but he told me at one point he wanted to become a lawyer. And So they gained a lot of respect for him. Damien, he started a lot of controversy when I interviewed him when he was on death row in 2010. He had written me a letter and invited me to come down and interview him, so I decided to do it. And while we were in the middle of our conversation, he told me that he thought that being a prison guard job was like a magnet for homosexuals, was his exact quote to me. And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Because these guys, they'll just take me into a room and they'll just rape me." And he goes, "I don't even fight back." And I was like, "Really?" And so, you know, I was like, "Wow, I mean, you know, this is pretty incendiary stuff." And so before I wrote the story, I called his attorneys. I'm like, "Hey, he told me this stuff." And I even talked to Lori about it. And they didn't really want him to go into all that, but he did. And I wrote a story about it. And I guess it caused a lot of trouble down there at the prison and all sorts of stuff. So, but yeah, he told me, he said he wouldn't even fight back. You know, they would just take him into a room and torture him and do all sorts of stuff to him. So, yeah, prison is a brutal place. I mean, I don't recommend anybody going.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking to hear that these guards were, he said, were worse than the inmates, and he was gang raped by inmates as well. So beatings and gang rapes,
yes.
and just a horrible time that he had. You also talk about that he spoke to you about his early life, and it was a profound moment in court was his mother showed up in court in a wheelchair but didn't leave with him at the end of it. Tell us what he said about his background and the shame. Tell us about that.
You know, he grew up in the impoverished, you know, Arkansas Delta. I mean, if you've never been in the Delta, it's one of the poorest places in the United States of America. I mean, Arkansas is a really funny and interesting state. You know, you've got Northwest Arkansas, which is probably one of the richest places in the world. You know, it's the, you know, like the Walmart, all the heirs to the Walmart fortune, you know, Dillard's, Tyson, you know, Foods, all these mega companies that it always surprises me that a small state like Arkansas just keeps producing.
Right.
So you've got all that in the Northwest sector. Well, then in the, you know, Eastern Arkansas, you've got, you know, just abject poverty and around the Mississippi River. And he vividly described that in his autobiography that he wrote about it, Life After Death. He grew up poor. He grew up in trailer parks. He didn't know a lot of times where he was going to eat. His mom dated many, many different men in some very odd and bizarre circumstances. And he hated his stepdad, which ironically enough, Jack Eccles, but he ended up taking his last name. And because actually his original name is actually Michael Hutchinson. But anyway, yeah, he grew up in poverty, and the only thing that he could do, the reason why he wears a long trench coat and acted bizarrely at school, he did it for attention. And he told me that. And it was, and he did it for attention, and he also did it so people wouldn't pick on him, so they'd leave him alone. And so that's why he said some bizarre things and thought some bizarre thoughts at the time. So that's where he grew up. You know, West Memphis is crime riddled. You drive through there, the average median income there is probably $25,000 below the national average. There's a very high amount of transient population that goes through there. I-40 and I-55, I-55 connects Canada basically to Mexico and comes all the way through the United States. It meets at West Memphis with I-40, which connects the West Coast to the East Coast, through the Southern route. So a lot of goods get moved through there, a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of crime, a lot of poor people, and he grew up in the middle of all of it.
You do have some conclusions, and I won't get into all of them. Save that for people to read for themselves, but tell us what you felt about the crime itself. Who we didn't mention, and it's people are aware of the mysterious black man at the DeJango's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about that person of interest and what you think his importance is to this case, and give us a little bit of what you thought happened and who might have done it.
It's so mind-blowing to me that you can have an officer, Regina Meeks. She gets the call the night the boys disappear. John Mark Byers and Dana Moore report their son's missing to her. Within minutes of getting this report, within an hour of getting this report, she is called to the Bojangles restaurant, which is in the vicinity. In that restaurant, some witnesses saw a black man stumble into the women's restroom. He defecates on the floor. He's covered in blood. He takes an industrial toilet paper roll and just presses it up to the wound, and it bleeds all the way to the center core of this huge toilet roll. He's jamming things into a toilet, trying to flush them down. And people see him doing this, and so they tell the manager. The manager calls the police. She comes to the Bojangles restaurant and takes a report through the drive-thru. She doesn't even bother going to the bathroom. Well, they go in and clean up this whole mess. Now, this restaurant is located about a half a mile from where the bodies are dumped. And if you were coming out of Robin Hood Hills and you were headed in that direction, I'm trying to think of a good way to describe it. It's not a trail, but it's kind of like it's like a ridge. There's a ridge that you could walk along to get out of Robin Hood Hills that would lead you directly into the parking lot of the Bojangles restaurant. So it would be a very reasonable route to take if you were there. And so she doesn't collect any evidence. They clean up the bathroom. Well, the next day, Brian Ridge, one of the officers who was working the West Memphis 3 case and also testified at the Rule 37 hearings, he goes in there, and they do find some blood on a wall, and they collect it and they put it in a baggie. He loses it. Now, why all this is important is because of this. They found a hair at the crime scene that belongs to a black man. They could never identify who this man's hair was. If they had the blood flake that was found on the wall, they could DNA test the two, and then they would know if that person was at the crime scene or not. And if they were at the crime scene, then they would probably have played some role in the three boys being murdered.
Right.
But because they lost evidence, we'll never know.
So what do you speculate this black man's role in this is, though? I mean, of all the information, this seems to be just an unknown puzzle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's unknown, and I mean, anything I would say would be speculative, but in my own mind, I know how these things work. If some point, if something happened to those three kids, the black guy probably, there were reports of gunshots in the woods that night in that vicinity near the Mayfield apartments, which are not far from Robin Hood Hills. I mean, it abutted the woods there. And so in my mind, if I'm just going to play this out logically, the black guy was probably a helper trying to help dump the bodies. And, you know, first rule of assassination, you always get rid of the assassins, right? And this guy had helped them and helped dump these bodies. And so as soon as they were dumped, and whoever he was helping just turned around and shot him, you know, to keep him quiet. And well, what's he going to do? Can he go to the police? No. I mean, he just helped dump all these three bodies in a creek. I hate to use, you know, the racial component of it too, but you're talking about, you know, 1993 in the South, black man, you know, white kids die. I mean, you know, if someone was involved in that, you know, they're not going to be lenient. So he's not going to the police for any reason. So I just can't believe that these two things can happen so close to each other and there not be a relationship, especially when you find a black hair at the crime scene. And it's also, I've been told, I don't know if this is a fact, I've been told that it was actually the best biological specimen that they found at the scene.
What do you think about Hobbs as, and the idea that he had someone else to help him? And of course, the obvious inference is this Jacoby, but this Jacoby claims doesn't help Hobbs at all, because he's one of the persons that says, listen, I had to intervene and stop this guy from beating little Stevie at one time. So tell us what you think about Hobbs and Jacoby.
Well, here's the thing, and this is for anybody who wants to talk about secondary hair transfer. I think it's very interesting. Terry Hobbs, the day of the murders, he claims that he did not see Stevie at all that day. He says, I didn't see him. He says that at around 5:30, he came home from work around 3:34. At that point, Stevie was already out in the neighborhood playing with his friends. Well, then he takes Pam to work. When he comes back from that, he goes over to Jacoby's house, and they start playing riffs to the song Pretty Woman. And he said he was there till about 6, and then he leaves. And Jacoby has confirmed this. What's interesting to me is I think if I had to bet money, I don't think Jacoby was with him. I don't think Jacoby took part in the crime. I think that when they talk about secondary hair transfer, that other hair was secondary hair transfer. Remember, Terry was playing guitar with him just a few minutes before the boys disappeared. So that hair could have definitely been a result of that. Now, Jacoby swears up and down he did not. He was not with Terry Hobbs. He has signed sworn affidavit saying he wasn't with him. He refutes all that. So, and I tell people, you know, I definitely think Terry Hobbs is a big time suspect in this case for sure. I said, you know, could you say definitively he did it? I can't, because I wasn't there, and they're still not. I would have to see a prosecutor put this all together and see what it looked like in a courtroom, and I go, okay, yeah, that probably makes sense. But definitely. A lot more, I mean, a lot of evidence. I mean, he fits the profile of the kind of person who could do this. I mean, the FBI profiler has said that. You know, he claimed he didn't see the three boys that day. Three women who were on their way to church at 6:30 that night came forward and didn't testify, but gave sworn affidavits in 2009 that they saw him that night motioning the three boys up to the house, or at least one of them, and the three boys went up to the house. And so, you know, this is what you're going to have to do. Is Terry Hobbs telling the truth about this, or are those three women who are on their way to church? Why would they lie? I mean, that's the question. Yeah. What's the motivation? Did David Jacoby, is he lying, or is Terry Hobbs lying? Is John Mark Byers lying, or is Terry Hobbs lying? Is, you know, all these different competing statements that have been made, and that doesn't include the DNA. That doesn't include the possible alleged abuses against the kid. This is just, you know, when you're telling two and three and four and five different stories and everybody else is saying, no, that's wrong, you got a problem.
You also you got to put in the mix here, like the prosecutor that to conveniently find, has a, like you say, has an epiphany and then goes and looks behind Baldwin's home into a lake and then within minutes with a camera crew right there to record everything, finds this weapon. But you also have the idea that like you say, Hobbs doesn't have an alibi for a certain amount of time, and his behavior is suspicious. Why was he not questioned? That's what I was trying to tie in with this prosecutor that says this epiphany, and everything is fitting the way he has theorized. How come this – does anybody answer that question? Why was he never questioned? And why is he now not a credible suspect whatsoever?
The reason he's not a credible suspect now, and I've asked this question many times, and this is the same answer I get each time. They have three convictions in this case, and they, you know, they're not going to waste any more time or resources on a case until they get some new evidence. And so to the officials in Arkansas, this case is closed. It's over. They just want to forget about it, which is a shame. I mean, for many obvious reasons. Now, as far as him never being questioned originally, no one can answer that because all John Mark Byers was interviewed. Todd Moore, right. Michael Moore's dad, was interviewed. He wasn't even – he was verifiably not even in the state of Arkansas when the murders happened. Yeah. He was out of state. He was a truck driver. And so all these people were interviewed, but Hobbs was not. And this only came about because he tried to sue Natalie Maines. And so all his competing stories about where he was at and what he was doing, and he's given several. And, you know, and I've talked with Terry, several times, and he constantly, there for a while, he was definitely worried, that they were going to, like, he told me one time that his daughter Amanda, he was definitely worried that, because she was talking to some of the film crews and Amy Berg from West of Memphis, and they wanted to put her under hypnosis. And he told me he was deathly afraid that she was going to conjure some, they were going to conjure some memory into her head that she had, witnessed him beating her son or beating her brother to death and his friends. And so he was scared to death of that. And I was like, well, we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, I don't know what to say to him when he was saying this. So, but anyway, yeah, I mean, If I was a prosecutor, I mean, I don't understand why you wouldn't at least, or if you're a detective, why wouldn't you put this all together and then ask for a prosecutor to file a charge? I mean, there's more than enough here.
You know, what's amazing is what you just told me sounds very similar to when he has a story that seems very incriminating, and this one where he says, listen, I'm very worried about my daughter being under hypnosis and then coming up, conjuring up an image of me beating the kids to death. I mean, it sounds almost the same. It sounds eerily incriminating.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like when he was telling John Mark Byers a story about them not being, the person who did it not being a monster, you know?
That's right, exactly.
I mean, it's kind of the similar kind of, brain pattern. And the other thing that you asked about, the knife behind Jason Baldwin's lake, or the lake behind Jason Baldwin's house, that is, okay, I talked to a reporter one time and who was there when this whole thing happened. What happened was, to let your listeners know, what happened was is the month after the initial arrest, they still hadn't found the knife. They had this theory that these boys were hacked up with a knife. And so they were looking for a knife. They were trying to find a weapon. They knew they needed one. Juries like to see murder weapons, They want to see what you use to kill somebody with. I mean, I was in court one time, and a guy had used, like, a candle holder, or I'm sorry, a cross that the woman he killed, her family had donated to a church, and he beat her to death so that he was a transient. And that cross, I'll never forget seeing in court. It just sat there. So having the knife is a big deal, They want the knife. So John Fogelman, his prosecutor, he has an epiphany one day. He decides that they need to go and they need to look behind Jason Baldwin's house. It was an industrial lake. He said, I'll bet the knife is there. So they go out there, they look, and within 30 minutes, they find a knife. And it's that Rambo-style knife that was seen in court. And the suspicious thing about it was, and I talked to a reporter who was there, a reporter who, by the way, believes these guys are, or at least at the time when the story was told to me, believed they were guilty. The reporter told me that it was kind of weird because it was almost like they were told where to stand when the divers came out of the water so they could get the best picture of the knife.
Yeah.
And here's the other part of that that's weird. Prosecutors prosecute cases. Police and detectives investigate cases. Okay? It's very odd for a prosecutor to interject himself in the investigation phase of the case like that. It's just a peculiar circumstance. It should have been the police. Like, if he thought that, you know, he could have called the police chief, but it was just a weird, like, why didn't the police chief say, hey, we need to go check that lake out behind the trailer house for evidence? So it was just really weird.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly convenient. I want to thank you, George, for coming on and talking about witches in West Memphis, the West Memphis 3, and another false confession. It's been very enjoyable. Thank you very much, George. For those that might want to look at other work, or do you have a Facebook page, website? Tell us about that.
I do. I'm on Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble, snag one of my books. Also, I'd also like to just plug this in there, too. The last chapter of the book is about another false confession case that happened almost 2 years to the day after these three guys were released from prison. It's in the same judicial district because the prosecutor in the case told me he didn't believe in false confessions. 2 years to the day, a 17-year-old mentally indigent guy named Christopher Sal confessed to the murder of an 11-year-old girl named Jessica Williams, who disappeared in 2013 in a town called Gosnell, which is about an hour's drive from West Memphis. They found her body in a drainage ditch the day after she disappeared, and within 24 hours, her neighbor confessed to her murder. He even got a detail or two of it right, and he sat in jail for 8 months waiting for his trial. The only problem was he didn't kill her. And what saved him was they found one sperm cell on her body, one. They DNA tested it, and it didn't belong to him. And so I include that as the last chapter of the book just because, you know, everybody believes in, you know, anybody who believes they're guilty believes Jesse that he didn't falsely confess. Well, in the same judicial district, same prosecutor, 50 miles from where this whole thing happened, the same exact thing happened 2 years later, almost to the day. It's almost unbelievable. And so I included that chapter in there just so people understand that this does happen, happens all the time, happens everywhere. And you can check me out, author George Jared, on Facebook. I've got Instagram. Just message me on there, and whatever way you want to communicate with me, I'm more than happy to do it.
Well, thank you very much, George Jared, for speaking about witches in West Memphis. Hope to speak to you again soon. Good night.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.